Say, I am a child of earth and of starry heaven, but my race is of heaven alone. This ye know yourselves, and lo, I am parched with thirst, and I perish. Give me quickly the cold water flowing forth from the lake of memory. And of themselves they will give thee to drink from the holy wellspring, and thereafter among the other heroes thou shalt have lordship. Another tablet says, Hail, thou who hast suffered the suffering, thou art become God from man. And yet in another, Happy and blessed one, thou shalt be God instead of mortal. The wellspring of which the soul is not to drink is Lethe, which brings forgetfulness. The other wellspring is Mnemosyne, remembrance. The soul in the next world, if it is to achieve salvation, is not to forget, but on the contrary, to acquire a memory surpassing what is natural. The Orphics were an ascetic sect. Wine to them was only a symbol, as later in the Christian sacrament. The intoxication that they sought was that of enthusiasm, of union with the God. They believed themselves in this way to acquire mystic knowledge, not obtainable by ordinary means. This mystical element entered into Greek philosophy with Pythagoras, who was a reformer of Orphism, as Orpheus was a reformer of the religion of Bacchus. From Pythagoras, Orphic elements entered into the philosophy of Plato, and from Plato into most later philosophy that was in any degree religious. Certain definitely Bacchic elements survived wherever Orphism had influence. One of these was feminism, of which there was much in Pythagoras, and which in Plato went so far as to claim complete political equality for women. Women as a sex, says Pythagoras, are more naturally akin to piety. Another Bacchic element was respect for violent emotion. Greek tragedy grew out of the rites of Dionysus. Euripides especially honored the two chief gods of Orphism, Bacchus and Eros. He has no respect for the coldly self-righteous, well-behaved man, who in his tragedies is apt to be driven mad or otherwise brought to grief by the gods in resentment of his blasphemy. The conventional tradition concerning the Greeks is that they exhibited an admirable serenity, which enabled them to contemplate passion from without, perceiving whatever beauty it exhibited, but themselves calm and Olympian. This is a very one-sided view. It is true, perhaps, of Homer, Sophocles, and Aristotle, but it is emphatically not true of those Greeks who were touched, directly or indirectly, by Bacchic or Orphic influences. At Eleusis, where the Eleusinian mysteries formed the most sacred part of Athenian state religion, a hymn was sung, saying, With thy wine cup waving high, with thy maddening revelry, to Eleusis' flowery vale comest thou, Bacchus, paean, hail. In the Bacchae of Euripides, the chorus of Maenads displays a combination of poetry and savagery which is the very reverse of serene. They celebrate the delight in tearing a wild animal limb from limb and eating it raw then and there. O glad, glad on the mountains, to swoon in the race outworn, when the holy fawn skin clings and all else sweeps away, to the joy of the quick red fountains, the blood of the hill goat torn, the glory of wild beast ravenings where the hilltop catches the day, to the Phrygian, Lydian mountains, 'tis Bromios leads the way. Bromios was another of the many names of Bacchus. The dance of the Maenads on the mountainside was not only fierce, it was an escape from the burdens and cares of civilization into the world of non-human beauty and the freedom of wind and stars. In a less frenzied mood, they sing, Will they ever come to me, ever again, the long, long dances, on through the dark till the dim stars wane? Shall I feel the dew on my throat and the stream of wind in my hair? Shall our white feet gleam in the dim expanses? O feet of the fawn to the greenwood fled, alone in the grass and the loveliness, leap of the hunted, no more in dread, beyond the snares and the deadly press. Yet a voice still in the distance sounds, a voice and a fear and a haste of hounds, O wildly laboring, fiercely fleet, onward yet by river and glen, Is it joy or terror, ye storm-swift feet, to the dear lone lands untroubled of men, where no voice sounds, and amid the shadowy green, the little things of the woodland live unseen? Before repeating that the Greeks were serene, try to imagine the matrons of Philadelphia behaving in this manner, even in a play by Eugene O'Neill. The Orphic is no more serene than the unreformed worshipper of Bacchus. To the Orphic, life in this world is pain and weariness. We are bound to a wheel which turns through endless cycles of birth and death. Our true life is at the stars, but we are tied to earth. Only by purification and renunciation and an ascetic life can we escape from the wheel and attain at last to the ecstasy of union with God. This is not the view of men to whom life is easy and pleasant. It is more like the Negro spiritual, "I am going to tell God all of my troubles when I get home." Not all of the Greeks, but a large proportion of them, were passionate, unhappy, at war with themselves, driven along one road by the intellect and along another by the passions, with the imagination to conceive heaven and the willful self-assertion that creates hell. They had a maxim, nothing too much. But they were, in fact, excessive in everything, in pure thought, in poetry, in religion, and in sin. It was the combination of passion and intellect that made them great while they were great. Neither alone would have transformed the world for all future time as they transformed it. Their prototype in mythology is not Olympian Zeus, but Prometheus, who brought fire from heaven and was rewarded with eternal torment. If taken as characterizing the Greeks as a whole, however, what has just been said would be as one-sided as the view that the Greeks were characterized by serenity. There were, in fact, two tendencies in Greece. One passionate, religious, mystical, otherworldly, the other cheerful, empirical, rationalistic, and interested in acquiring knowledge of a diversity of facts. Herodotus represents this latter tendency. So do the earliest Ionian philosophers. So, up to a point, does Aristotle. Belloc, work cited 1-1, page 434, after describing Orphism, says, "But the Greek nation was too full of youthful vigor for the general acceptance of a belief which denies this world and transfers real life to the beyond. Accordingly, the Orphic doctrine remained confined to the relatively narrow circle of the initiate, without acquiring the smallest influence on the state religion, not even in communities which, like Athens, had taken up the celebration of the mysteries into the state ritual and placed it under legal protection. A full millennium was to pass before these ideas, in a quite different theological dress, it is true, achieved victory in the Greek world." It would seem that this is an overstatement, particularly as regards the Eleusinian mysteries, which were impregnated with Orphism. Broadly speaking, those who were of a religious temperament turned to Orphism, while rationalists despised it. One might compare its status to that of Methodism in England in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. We know more or less what an educated Greek learnt from his father, but we know very little of what, in his earliest years, he learnt from his mother, who was, to a great extent, shut out from the civilization in which the men took delight. It seems probable that educated Athenians, even in the best period, however rationalistic they may have been in their explicitly conscious mental processes, retained from tradition and from childhood a more primitive way of thinking and feeling, which was always liable to prove victorious in times of stress. For this reason, no simple analysis of the Greek outlook is likely to be adequate. The influence of religion, more particularly of non-Olympian religion, on Greek thought, was not adequately recognized until recent times. A revolutionary book, Jane Harrison's Prolegomena to the Study of Greek Religion, emphasized both the primitive and the Dionysiac elements in the religion of ordinary Greeks. F.M. Comfort's From Religion to Philosophy tried to make students of Greek philosophy aware of the influence of religion on the philosophers, but cannot be wholly accepted as trustworthy in many of its interpretations, or, for that matter, in its anthropology. The most balanced statement known to me is in John Burnett's Early Greek Philosophy, especially Chapter 2, Science and Religion. A conflict between science and religion arose, he says, out of the religious revival which swept over Hellas in the 6th century BC, together with the shifting of the scene from Ionia to the west. The religion of continental Hellas, he says, had developed in a very different way from that of Ionia. In particular, the worship of Dionysus, which came from Thrace and is barely mentioned in Homer, contained in germ a wholly new way of looking at man's relation to the world. It would certainly be wrong to credit the Thracians themselves with any very exalted views, but there can be no doubt that to the Greeks, the phenomenon of ecstasy suggested that the soul was something more than a feeble double of the self, and that it was only when out of the body that it could show its true nature. It looked as if Greek religion were about to enter on the same stage as that already reached by the religions of the East. And but for the rise of science, it is hard to see what could have checked this tendency. It is usual to say that the Greeks were saved from a religion of the Oriental type by their having no priesthood. But this is to mistake the effect for the cause. Priesthoods do not make dogmas, though they preserve them once they are made. And in the earlier stages of their development, the Oriental peoples had no priesthoods either, in the sense intended. It was not so much the absence of a priesthood as the existence of the scientific schools that saved Greece. The new religion, for in one sense it was new, though in another as old as mankind, reached its highest point of development with the foundation of the Orphic communities. So far as we can see, the original home of these was Attica, but they spread with extraordinary rapidity, especially in southern Italy and Sicily. They were first of all associations for the worship of Dionysus, but they were distinguished by two features which were new among the Hellenes. They looked to a revelation as the source of religious authority, and they were organized as artificial communities. The poems which contained their theology were ascribed to the Thracian Orpheus, who had himself descended into Hades, and was therefore a safe guide through the perils which beset the disembodied soul in the next world. Burnett goes on to state that there is a striking similarity between Orphic beliefs and those prevalent in India at about the same time, though he holds that there cannot have been any contact. He then comes on to the original meaning of the word orgy, which was used by the Orphics to mean sacrament and was intended to purify the believer's soul and enable it to escape from the wheel of birth. The Orphics, unlike the priests of Olympian cults, founded what we may call churches, that is, religious communities to which anybody, without distinction of race or sex, could be admitted by initiation, and from their influence arose the conception of philosophy as a way of life. Chapter 2. The Milesian School. In every history of philosophy for students, the first thing mentioned is that philosophy began with Thales, who said that everything is made of water. This is discouraging to the beginner, who is struggling, perhaps not very hard, to feel that respect for philosophy which the curriculum seems to expect. There is, however, ample reason to feel respect for Thales, though perhaps rather as a man of science than as a philosopher in the modern sense of the word. Thales was a native of Miletus in Asia Minor, a flourishing commercial city in which there was a large slave population and a bitter class struggle between the rich and poor among the free population. At Miletus, the people were at first victorious and murdered the wives and children of the aristocrats, then the aristocrats prevailed and burned their opponents alive, lighting up the open spaces of the city with live torches. Similar conditions prevailed in most of the Greek cities of Asia Minor at the time of Thales. Miletus, like other commercial cities of Ionia, underwent important economic and political developments during the 7th and 6th centuries. At first, political power belonged to a land-owning aristocracy, but this was gradually replaced by a plutocracy of merchants. They, in turn, were replaced by a tyrant, who, as was usual, achieved power by the support of the democratic party. The kingdom of Lydia lay to the east of the Greek coast towns, but remained on friendly terms with them until the fall of Nineveh, 612 BC. This left Lydia free to turn its attention to the west, but Miletus usually succeeded in preserving friendly relations, especially with Croesus, the last Lydian king, who was conquered by Cyrus in 546 BC. There were also important relations with Egypt, where the king depended upon Greek mercenaries and had opened certain cities to Greek trade. The first Greek settlement in Egypt was a fort occupied by a Milesian garrison, but the most important during the period 610 to 560 BC was Daphne. Here, Jeremiah and many other Jewish refugees took refuge from Nebuchadrezzar. Jeremiah chapter 43, verse 5 and following. But while Egypt undoubtedly influenced the Greeks, the Jews did not, nor can we suppose that Jeremiah felt anything but horror towards the skeptical Ionians. As regards the date of Thales, the best evidence, as we saw, is that he was famous for predicting an eclipse, which, according to the astronomers, must have taken place in 585 BC. Other evidence, such as it is, agrees in placing his activities at about this time. It is no proof of extraordinary genius on his part to have predicted an eclipse. Miletus was allied with Lydia, and Lydia had cultural relations with Babylonia, and Babylonian astronomers had discovered that eclipses recur in a cycle of about 19 years. They could predict eclipses of the moon with pretty complete success, but as regards solar eclipses, they were hampered by the fact that an eclipse may be visible in one place and not in another. Consequently, they could only know that at such and such a date it was worthwhile to look out for an eclipse, and this is probably all that Thales knew. Neither he nor they knew why there is this cycle. Thales is said to have travelled in Egypt, and to have thence brought to the Greeks the science of geometry. What the Egyptians knew of geometry was mainly rules of thumb, and there is no reason to believe that Thales arrived at deductive proofs, such as later Greeks discovered. He seems to have discovered how to calculate the distance of a ship at sea from observations taken at two points on land, and how to estimate the height of a pyramid from the length of its shadow. Many other geometrical theorems are attributed to him, but probably wrongly. He was one of the seven wise men of Greece, each of whom was specially noted for one wise saying. His, according to tradition, was, "Water is best." According to Aristotle, he thought that water is the original substance out of which all others are formed, and he maintained that the earth rests on water. Aristotle also says of him that he said the magnet has a soul in it because it moves the iron. Further, that all things are full of gods. Footnote: Burnet, Early Greek Philosophy, page 51, questions this last saying. End of footnote. The statement that everything is made of water is to be regarded as a scientific hypothesis, and by no means a foolish one. 20 years ago, the received view was that everything is made of hydrogen, which is two-thirds of water. The Greeks were rash in their hypotheses, but the Milesian school at least was prepared to test them empirically. Too little is known of Thales to make it possible to reconstruct him at all satisfactorily, but of his successes in Miletus much more is known, and it is reasonable to suppose that something of their outlook came from him. His science and his philosophy were both crude, but they were such as to stimulate both thought and observation. There are many legends about him, but I do not think more is known than the few facts I have mentioned. Some of the stories are pleasant, for instance, the one told by Aristotle in his Politics. He was reproached for his poverty, which was supposed to show that philosophy is of no use. According to the story, he knew by his skill in the stars, while it was yet winter, that there would be a great harvest of olives in the coming year. So, having a little money, he gave deposits for the use of all the olive presses in Chios and Miletus, which he hired at a low price because no one bid against him. When the harvest time came, and many were wanted all at once and of a sudden, he let them out at any rate which he pleased, and made a quantity of money. Thus he showed the world that philosophers can easily be rich if they like, but that their ambition is of another sort. Anaximander, the second philosopher of the Milesian school, is much more interesting than Thales. His dates are uncertain, but he was said to have been 64 years old in 546 BC, and there is reason to suppose that this is somewhere near the truth. He held that all things come from a single primal substance, but that it is not water, as Thales held, or any other of the substances that we know. It is infinite, eternal, and ageless, and it encompasses all the worlds, for he thought our world only one of many, The primal substance is transformed into the various substances with which we are familiar, and these are transformed into each other. As to this, he makes an important and remarkable statement. Into that from which things take their rise, they pass away once more, as is ordained, for they make reparation and satisfaction to one another for their injustice according to the ordering of time. The idea of justice, both cosmic and human, played a part in Greek religion and philosophy which is not altogether easy for a modern to understand. Indeed, our word justice hardly expresses what is meant, but it is difficult to find any other word that would be preferable. The thought which Anaximander is expressing seems to be this. There should be a certain proportion of fire, of earth, and of water in the world. But each element, conceived as a god, is perpetually attempting to enlarge its empire. But there is a kind of necessity or natural law which perpetually redresses the balance. Where there has been fire, for example, there are ashes, which are earth. This conception of justice, of not overstepping eternally fixed bounds, was one of the most profound of Greek beliefs. The gods were subject to justice just as much as men were, but this supreme power was not itself personal, and was not a supreme god. Anaximander had an argument to prove that the primal substance could not be water, or any other known element. If one of these were primal, it would conquer the others. Aristotle reports him as saying that these known elements are in opposition to one another. Air is cold, water is moist, and fire is hot. And therefore, if any one of them were infinite, the rest would have ceased to be by this time. The primal substance, therefore, must be neutral in this cosmic strife. There was an eternal motion in the course of which was brought about the origin of the worlds. The worlds were not created, as in Jewish or Christian theology, but evolved. There was evolution also in the animal kingdom. Living creatures arose from the moist element as it was evaporated by the sun. Man, like every other animal, was descended from fishes. He must be derived from animals of a different sort, because owing to his long infancy, he could not have survived originally as he is now. Anaximander was full of scientific curiosity. He is said to have been the first man who made a map. He held that the earth is shaped like a cylinder. He is variously reported as saying the sun is as large as the earth, or 27 times as large, or 28 times as large. Wherever he is original, he is scientific and rationalistic. Anaximenes, the last of the Milesian triad, is not quite so interesting as Anaximander, but makes some important advances. His dates are very uncertain. He was certainly subsequent to Anaximander, and he certainly flourished before 494 BC, since in that year Miletus was destroyed by the Persians in the course of their suppression of the Ionian Revolt. The fundamental substance, he said, is air. The soul is air. Fire is rarefied air. When condensed, air becomes first water, then, if further condensed, earth, and finally stone. This theory has the merit of making all the differences between different substances quantitative, depending entirely upon the degree of condensation. He thought that the earth is shaped like a round table, and that air encompasses everything. Just as our soul, being air, holds us together, so do breath and air encompass the whole world. It seems that the world breathes. Anaximenes was more admired in antiquity than Anaximander, though almost any modern world would make the opposite valuation. He had an important influence on Pythagoras and on much subsequent speculation. The Pythagoreans discovered that the earth is spherical, but the atomists adhered to the view of Anaximenes, that it is shaped like a disk. The Milesian school is important, not for what it achieved, but for what it attempted. It was brought into existence by the contact of the Greek mind with Babylonia and Egypt. Miletus was a rich commercial city, in which primitive prejudices and superstitions were softened by intercourse with many nations. Ionia, until its subjugation by Darius at the beginning of the 5th century, was culturally the most important part of the Hellenic world. It was almost untouched by the religious movement connected with Bacchus and Orpheus. Its religion was Olympic, but seems to have been not taken very seriously. The speculations of Thales, Anaximander, and Anaximenes are to be regarded as scientific hypotheses, and seldom show any undue intrusion of anthropomorphic desires and moral ideas. The questions they asked were good questions, and their vigor inspired subsequent investigators. The next stage in Greek philosophy, which is associated with the Greek cities in southern Italy, is more religious and, in particular, more Orphic. In some ways more interesting, admirable in achievement, but in spirit less scientific than that of the Milesians. Chapter 3. Pythagoras. Pythagoras, whose influence in ancient and modern times is my subject in this chapter, was intellectually one of the most important men that ever lived, both when he was wise and when he was unwise. Mathematics, in the sense of demonstrative deductive argument, begins with him, and in him is intimately connected with a peculiar form of mysticism. The influence of mathematics on philosophy, partly owing to him, has ever since his time been both profound and unfortunate. Let us begin with what little is known of his life. He was a native of the island of Samos and flourished about 532 BC. Some say he was the son of a substantial citizen named Nausarchos, others that he was the son of the god Apollo. I leave the reader to take his choice between these alternatives. In his time, Samos was ruled by the tyrant Polycrates, an old ruffian who became immensely rich and had a vast navy. Samos was a commercial rival of Miletus. Its traders went as far afield as Tartessus in Spain, which was famous for its mines. Polycrates became tyrant of Samos about 535 BC and reigned until 515 BC. He was not much troubled by moral scruples. He got rid of his two brothers, who were at first associated with him in the tyranny, and he used his navy largely for piracy. He profited by the fact that Miletus had recently submitted to Persia. In order to obstruct any further westward expansion of the Persians, he allied himself with Amasis, king of Egypt. But when Cambyses, king of Persia, devoted his full energies to the conquest of Egypt, Polycrates realized that he was likely to win and changed sides. He sent a fleet composed of his political enemies to attack Egypt. But the crews mutinied and returned to Samos to attack him. He got the better of them, however, but fell at last by a treacherous appeal to his avarice. The Persian satrap at Sardis represented that he intended to rebel against the great king and would pay vast sums for the help of Polycrates, who went to the mainland for an interview, was captured, and crucified. Polycrates was a patron of the arts and beautified Samos with remarkable public works. Anacreon was his court poet. Pythagoras, however, disliked his government and therefore left Samos. It is said, and is not improbable, that Pythagoras visited Egypt and learnt much of his wisdom there. However that may be, it is certain that he ultimately established himself at Croton in southern Italy. The Greek cities of southern Italy, like Samos and Miletus, were rich and prosperous. Moreover, they were not exposed to danger from the Persians. Footnote. The Greek cities of Sicily were in danger from the Carthaginians, but in Italy this danger was not felt to be imminent. End of footnote. The two greatest were Sybaris and Croton. Sybaris has remained proverbial for luxury. Its population in its greatest days is said by Diodorus to have amounted to 300,000, though this is no doubt an exaggeration. Croton was about equal in size to Sybaris. Both cities lived by importing Ionian wares into Italy, partly for consumption in that country, partly for re-export from the western coast of Gaul and Spain. The various Greek cities of Italy fought each other fiercely. When Pythagoras arrived in Croton, it had just been defeated by Locri. Soon after his arrival, however, Croton was completely victorious in a war against Sybaris, which was utterly destroyed, 510 BC. Sybaris had been closely linked in commerce with Miletus. Croton was famous for medicine. A certain Demosides of Croton became physician to Polycrates and then to Darius. At Croton, Pythagoras founded a society of disciples, which for a time was influential in that city. But in the end, the citizens turned against him, and he moved to Metapontion, also in southern Italy, where he died. He soon became a mythical figure, credited with miracles and magic powers, but he was also the founder of a school of mathematicians. Footnote. Aristotle says of him that he first worked at mathematics and arithmetic, and afterwards, at one time, condescended to the wonder-working practiced by Pharisees. End of footnote. Thus, two opposing traditions disputed his memory, and the truth is hard to disentangle. Pythagoras is one of the most interesting and puzzling men in history. Not only are the traditions concerning him an almost inextricable mixture of truth and falsehood, but even in their barest and least disputable form, they present us with a very curious psychology. He may be described briefly as a combination of Einstein and Mrs. Eddy. He founded a religion of which the main tenets were the transmigration of souls and the sinfulness of eating beans. Footnote. Clown. What is the opinion of Pythagoras concerning wildfowl? Malvolio. That the soul of our grandam might haply inhabit a bird. Clown. What thinkest thou of his opinion? Malvolio. I think nobly of the soul, and no way approve his opinion. Clown. Fare thee well. Remain thou still in darkness. Thou shalt hold the opinion of Pythagoras ere I will allow of thy wits. Twelfth Night. End of footnote. His religion was embodied in a religious order, which here and there acquired control of the state and established a rule of the saints. But the unregenerate hankered after beans, and sooner or later rebelled. Some of the rules of the Pythagorean order were: 1. To abstain from beans. 2. Not to pick up what has fallen. 3. Not to touch a white cock. 4. Not to break bread. 5. Not to step over a crossbar. 6. Not to stir the fire with iron. 7. Not to eat from a whole loaf. 8. Not to pluck a garland. 9. Not to sit on a quart measure. 10. Not to eat the heart. 11. Not to walk on highways. 12. Not to let swallows share one's roof. 13. When the pot is taken off the fire, not to leave the mark of it in the ashes, but to stir them together. 14. Do not look in a mirror beside a light. 15. When you rise from the bedclothes, roll them together and smooth out the impress of the body. All these precepts belong to primitive taboo conceptions. Cornford, from Religion to Philosophy, says that, in his opinion, the school of Pythagoras represents the main current of that mystical tradition which we have set in contrast with the scientific tendency. He regards Parmenides, whom he calls the discoverer of logic, as an offshoot of Pythagoreanism, and Plato himself as finding in the Italian philosophy the chief source of his inspiration. Pythagoreanism, he says, was a movement of reform in Orphism, and Orphism was a movement of reform in the worship of Dionysus. The opposition of the rational and the mystical, which runs all through history, first appears among the Greeks as an opposition between the Olympic gods and those other less civilized gods who had more affinity with the primitive beliefs dealt with by anthropologists. In this division, Pythagoras was on the side of mysticism, though his mysticism was of a peculiarly intellectual sort. He attributed to himself a semi-divine character and appears to have said, "There are men and gods and beings like Pythagoras." All the systems that he inspired, Cornford says, tend to be otherworldly, putting all value in the unseen unity of God and condemning the visible world as false and elusive, a turbid medium in which the rays of heavenly light are broken and obscured in mist and darkness. Dicaiarchus says that Pythagoras taught, first, that the soul is an immortal thing, and that it is transformed into other kinds of living things. Further, that whatever comes into existence is born again in the revolutions of a certain cycle, nothing being absolutely new, and that all things that are born with life in them ought to be treated as kindred. It is said that Pythagoras, like St. Francis, preached to animals. In the society that he founded, men and women were admitted on equal terms. Property was held in common, and there was a common way of life. Even scientific and mathematical discoveries were deemed collective, and in a mystical sense due to Pythagoras even after his death. Hippasus of Metapontion, who violated this rule, was shipwrecked as a result of divine wrath at his impiety. But what has all this to do with mathematics? It is connected by means of an ethic which praised the contemplative life. Burnet sums up this ethic as follows. We are strangers in this world, and the body is the tomb of the soul, and yet we must not seek to escape by self-murder, for we are the chattels of God, who is our herdsman, and without his command we have no right to make our escape. In this life there are three kinds of men, just as there are three sorts of people who come to the Olympic Games. The lowest class is made up of those who come to buy and sell. The next above them are those who compete. Best of all, however, are those who come simply to look on. The greatest purification of all is therefore disinterested science, and it is the man who devotes himself to that, the true philosopher, who has most effectually released himself from the wheel of birth. The changes in the meanings of words are often very instructive. I spoke above about the word orgy. Now I want to speak about the word theory. This was originally an Orphic word, which Cornford interprets as passionate, sympathetic contemplation. In this state, he says, the spectator is identified with the suffering God, dies in his death, and rises again in his new birth. For Pythagoras, the passionate, sympathetic contemplation was intellectual and issued in mathematical knowledge. In this way, through Pythagoreanism, theory gradually acquired its modern meaning. But for all who were inspired by Pythagoras, it retained an element of ecstatic revelation. To those who have reluctantly learnt a little mathematics in school, this may seem strange. But to those who have experienced the intoxicating delight of sudden understanding that mathematics gives from time to time, to those who love it, the Pythagorean view will seem completely natural, even if untrue. It might seem that the empirical philosopher is the slave of his material, but that the pure mathematician, like the musician, is a free creator of his world of ordered beauty. It is interesting to observe, in Burnet's account of the Pythagorean ethic, the opposition to modern values. In connection with a football match, modern-minded men think the players grander than the mere spectators. Similarly, as regards the state, they admire more the politicians who are the contestants in the game than those who are only onlookers. This change of values is connected with a change in the social system. The warrior, the gentleman, the plutocrat, and the dictator, each has his own standard of the good and the true. The gentleman has had a long innings in philosophical theory because he is associated with the Greek genius, because the virtue of contemplation acquired theological endorsement, and because the ideal of disinterested truth dignified the academic life. The gentleman is to be defined as one of a society of equals who live on slave labor, or at any rate upon the labor of men whose inferiority is unquestioned. It should be observed that this definition includes the saint and the sage, insofar as these men's lives are contemplative rather than active. Modern definitions of truth, such as those of pragmatism and instrumentalism, which are practical rather than contemplative, are inspired by industrialism as opposed to aristocracy. Whatever may be thought of a social system which tolerates slavery, it is to gentlemen, in the above sense, that we owe pure mathematics. The contemplative ideal, since it led to the creation of pure mathematics, was the source of a useful activity. This increased its prestige and gave it a success in theology, in ethics, and in philosophy, which it might not otherwise have enjoyed. So much by way of explanation of the two aspects of Pythagoras, as religious prophet and as pure mathematician. In both respects, he was immeasurably influential, and the two were not so separate as they seem to a modern mind. Most sciences, at their inception, have been connected with some form of false belief which gave them a fictitious value. Astronomy was connected with astrology, chemistry with alchemy. Mathematics was associated with a more refined type of error. Mathematical knowledge appeared to be certain, exact, and applicable to the real world. Moreover, it was obtained by mere thinking, without the need of observation. Consequently, it was thought to supply an ideal, from which everyday empirical knowledge fell short. It was supposed, on the basis of mathematics, that thought is superior to sense, intuition to observation. If the world of sense does not fit mathematics, so much the worse for the world of sense. In various ways, methods of approaching nearer to the mathematician's ideal were sought, and the resulting suggestions were the source of much that was mistaken in metaphysics and theory of knowledge. This form of philosophy begins with Pythagoras. Pythagoras, as everyone knows, said that all things are numbers. This statement, interpreted in a modern way, is logically nonsense, but what he meant was not exactly nonsense. He discovered the importance of numbers in music, and the connection which he established between music and arithmetic survives in the mathematical terms harmonic mean and harmonic progression. He thought of numbers as shapes, as they appear on dice or playing cards. We still speak of squares and cubes of numbers, which are terms that we owe to him. He also spoke of oblong numbers, triangular numbers, pyramidal numbers, and so on. These were the numbers of pebbles, or as we should more naturally say, shot, required to make the shapes in question. He presumably thought of the world as atomic, and of bodies as built up of molecules composed of atoms arranged in various shapes. In this way, he hoped to make arithmetic the fundamental study in physics as in aesthetics. The greatest discovery of Pythagoras, or of his immediate disciples, was the proposition about right-angled triangles, that the sum of the squares on the sides adjoining the right angle is equal to the square on the remaining side, the hypotenuse. The Egyptians had known that a triangle whose sides are 3, 4, 5 has a right angle. But apparently the Greeks were the first to observe that 3 squared plus 4 squared equals 5 squared, and acting on this suggestion to discover a proof of the general proposition. Unfortunately for Pythagoras, his theorem led at once to the discovery of incommensurables, which appeared to disprove his whole philosophy. In a right-angled isosceles triangle, the square on the hypotenuse is double of the square on either side. Let us suppose each side an inch long. Then how long is the hypotenuse? Let us suppose its length is m over n inches. Then m squared over n squared equals 2. If m and n have a common factor, divide it out. Then either m or n must be odd. Now m squared equals 2n squared. Therefore m squared is even. Therefore m is even. Therefore n is odd. Suppose m equals 2p. Then 4p squared equals 2n squared. Therefore, n squared equals 2p squared, and therefore n is even, contra hype. Therefore, no fraction m over n will measure the hypotenuse. The above proof is substantially that in Euclid, Book 10. Footnote, but not by Euclid. The above proof was probably known to Plato. End of footnote. This argument proved that whatever unit of length we may adopt, there are lengths which bear no exact numerical relation to the unit, in the sense that there are no two integers m, n, such that m times the length in question is n times the unit. This convinced the Greek mathematicians that geometry must be established independently of arithmetic. There are passages in Plato's dialogues which prove that the independent treatment of geometry was well underway in his day. It is perfected in Euclid. Euclid, in Book 2, proves geometrically many things which we should naturally prove by algebra, such as parenthesis a plus b close parenthesis squared equals a squared plus 2ab plus b squared. It was because of the difficulty about incommensurables that he considered this course necessary. The same applies to his treatment of proportion in Books 5 and 6. The whole system is logically delightful and anticipates the rigor of 19th century mathematicians. So long as no adequate arithmetical theory of incommensurables existed, the method of Euclid was the best that was possible in geometry. When Descartes introduced coordinate geometry, thereby again making arithmetic supreme, he assumed the possibility of a solution of the problem of incommensurables, though in his day no such solution had been found. The influence of geometry upon philosophy and scientific method has been profound. Geometry, as established by the Greeks, starts with axioms which are, or are deemed to be, self-evident, and proceeds by deductive reasoning to arrive at theorems that are very far from self-evident. The axioms and theorems are held to be true of actual space, which is something given in experience. It thus appeared to be possible to discover things about the actual world by first noticing what is self-evident and then using deduction. This view influenced Plato and Kant, and most of the intermediate philosophers. When the Declaration of Independence says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," it is modeling itself on Euclid. The 18th century doctrine of natural rights is a search for Euclidean axioms in politics. Footnote. Self-evident was substituted by Franklin for Jefferson's sacred and undeniable. End of footnote. The form of Newton's Principia, in spite of its admittedly empirical material, is entirely dominated by Euclid. Theology, in its exact scholastic forms, takes its style from the same source. Personal religion is derived from ecstasy, theology from mathematics, and both are to be found in Pythagoras. Mathematics is, I believe, the chief source of the belief in eternal and exact truth, as well as in a super-sensible, intelligible world. Geometry deals with exact circles, but no sensible object is exactly circular. However carefully we may use our compasses, there will be some imperfections and irregularities. This suggests the view that all exact reasoning applies to ideal as opposed to sensible objects. It is natural to go further and to argue that thought is nobler than sense, and the objects of thought more real than those of sense perception. Mystical doctrines, as to the relation of time to eternity, are also reinforced by pure mathematics, for mathematical objects, such as numbers, if real at all, are eternal and not in time. Such eternal objects can be conceived as God's thoughts. Hence Plato's doctrine that God is a geometer, and Sir James Jeans' belief that he is addicted to arithmetic. Rationalistic, as opposed to apocalyptic religion, has been, ever since Pythagoras, and notably ever since Plato, very completely dominated by mathematics and mathematical method. The combination of mathematics and theology, which began with Pythagoras, characterized religious philosophy in Greece in the Middle Ages and in modern times down to Kant. Orphism, before Pythagoras, was analogous to Asiatic mystery religions. But in Plato, St. Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, Descartes, Spinoza, and Kant, there is an intimate blending of religion and reasoning, of moral aspiration with logical admiration of what is timeless, which comes from Pythagoras and distinguishes the intellectualized theology of Europe from the more straightforward mysticism of Asia. It is only in quite recent times that it has been possible to say clearly where Pythagoras was wrong. I do not know of any other man who has been as influential as he was in the sphere of thought. I say this because what appears as Platonism is, when analyzed, found to be in essence Pythagoreanism. The whole conception of an eternal world, revealed to the intellect but not to the senses, is derived from him. But for him, Christians would not have thought of Christ as the Word. But for him, theologians would not have sought logical proofs of God and immortality. But in him, all this is still implicit. How it became explicit will appear. Chapter 4. Heraclitus. Two opposite attitudes towards the Greeks are common at the present day. One, which was practically universal from the Renaissance until very recent times, views the Greeks with almost superstitious reverence, as the inventors of all that is best, and as men of superhuman genius whom the moderns cannot hope to equal. The other attitude, inspired by the triumphs of science and by an optimistic belief in progress, considers the authority of the ancients an incubus, and maintains that most of their contributions to thought are now best forgotten. I cannot myself take either of these extreme views. Each, I should say, is partly right and partly wrong. Before entering upon any detail, I shall try to say what sort of wisdom we can still derive from the study of Greek thought. As to the nature and structure of the world, various hypotheses are possible. Progress in metaphysics, so far as it has existed, has consisted in a gradual refinement of all these hypotheses, a development of their implications, and a reformulation of each to meet the objections urged by adherents of rival hypotheses. To learn to conceive the universe according to each of these systems is an imaginative delight and an antidote to dogmatism. Moreover, even if no one of the hypotheses can be demonstrated, there is genuine knowledge in the discovery of what is involved in making each of them consistent with itself and with known facts. Now, almost all the hypotheses that have dominated modern philosophy were first thought of by the Greeks. Their imaginative inventiveness in abstract matters can hardly be too highly praised. What I shall have to say about the Greeks will be said mainly from this point of view. I shall regard them as giving birth to theories which have had an independent life and growth, and which, though at first somewhat infantile, have proved capable of surviving and developing throughout more than 2,000 years. The Greeks contributed, it is true, something else which proved of more permanent value to abstract thought. They discovered mathematics and the art of deductive reasoning. Geometry, in particular, is a Greek invention, without which modern science would have been impossible. But in connection with mathematics, the one-sidedness of the Greek genius appears. It reasoned deductively from what appeared self-evident, not inductively from what had been observed. Its amazing successes in the employment of this method misled not only the ancient world, but the greater part of the modern world also. It has only been very slowly that scientific method, which seeks to reach principles inductively from observation of particular facts, has replaced the Hellenic belief in deduction from luminous axioms derived from the mind of the philosopher. For this reason, apart from others, it is a mistake to treat the Greeks with superstitious reverence. Scientific method, though some few among them were the first men who had an inkling of it, is on the whole alien to their temper of mind, and the attempt to glorify them by belittling the intellectual progress of the last four centuries has a cramping effect upon modern thought. There is, however, a more general argument against reverence, whether for the Greeks or for anyone else. In studying a philosopher, the right attitude is neither reverence nor contempt, but first a kind of hypothetical sympathy, until it is possible to know what it feels like to believe in his theories, and only then a revival of the critical attitude, which should resemble, as far as possible, the state of mind of a person abandoning opinions which he has hitherto held. Contempt interferes with the first part of this process, and reverence with the second. Two things are to be remembered. That a man whose opinions and theories are worth studying may be presumed to have had some intelligence, but that no man is likely to have arrived at complete and final truth on any subject whatever. When an intelligent man expresses a view which seems to us obviously absurd, we should not attempt to prove that it is somehow true, but we should try to understand how it ever came to seem true. This exercise of historical and psychological imagination at once enlarges the scope of our thinking and helps us to realize how foolish many of our own cherished prejudices will seem to an age which has a different temper of mind. Between Pythagoras and Heraclitus, with whom we shall be concerned in this chapter, there was another philosopher of less importance, namely Xenophanes. His date is uncertain, and is mainly determined by the fact that he alludes to Pythagoras, and Heraclitus alludes to him. He was an Ionian by birth, but lived most of his life in southern Italy. He believed all things to be made out of earth and water. As regards the gods, he was a very emphatic free thinker. Homer and Hesiod have ascribed to the gods all things that are a shame and a disgrace among mortals, stealings and adulteries and deceivings of one another. Mortals deem that gods are begotten as they are, and have clothes like theirs, and voice and form. Yes, and if oxen and horses or lions had hands, and could paint with their hands, and produce works of art as men do, Horses would paint the forms of gods like horses, and oxen like oxen, and make their bodies in the image of their several kinds. The Ethiopians make their gods black and snub-nosed. The Thracians say theirs have blue eyes and red hair. He believed in one God, unlike men in form and thought, who without toil swayeth all things by the force of his mind. Xenophanes made fun of the Pythagorean doctrine of transmigration. Once, they say, he, Pythagoras, was passing by when a dog was being ill-treated. "Stop," he said, "don't hit it. It is the soul of a friend. I knew it when I heard its voice." He believed it impossible to ascertain the truth in matters of theology. The certain truth, there is no man who knows, nor ever shall be, about the gods and all the things whereof I speak. Yea, even if a man should chance to say something utterly right, still he himself knows it not. There is nowhere anything but guessing. Xenophanes has his place in the succession of rationalists who were opposed to the mystical tendencies of Pythagoras and others, but as an independent thinker he is not in the first rank. The doctrine of Pythagoras, as we saw, is very difficult to disentangle from that of his disciples, and although Pythagoras himself is very early, the influence of his school is mainly subsequent to that of various other philosophers. The first of these to invent a theory which is still influential was Heraclitus, who flourished about 500 BC. Of his life, very little is known, except that he was an aristocratic citizen of Ephesus. He was chiefly famous in antiquity for his doctrine that everything is in a state of flux. But this, as we shall see, is only one aspect of his metaphysics. Heraclitus, though an Ionian, was not in the scientific tradition of the Milesians. Footnote. Cornford emphasizes this, I think rightly. Heraclitus is often misunderstood through being assimilated to other Ionians. End of footnote. He was a mystic, but of a peculiar kind. He regarded fire as the fundamental substance. Everything, like flame in a fire, is born by the death of something else. Mortals are immortals, and immortals are mortals, the one living the other's death and dying the other's life. There is unity in the world, but it is a unity formed by the combination of opposites. All things come out of the one, and the one out of all things. But the many have less reality than the one, which is God. From what survives of his writings, he does not appear as an amiable character. He was much addicted to contempt, and was the reverse of a democrat. Concerning his fellow citizens, he says, "The Ephesians would do well to hang themselves, every grown man of them, and leave the city to beardless lads, for they have cast out Hermodorus, the best man among them, saying, We will have none who is best among us. If there be any such, let him be so elsewhere and among others." He speaks ill of all his eminent predecessors, with a single exception. Homer should be turned out of the lists and whipped. Of all whose discourses I have heard, there is not one who attains to understanding that wisdom is apart from all. The learning of many things teacheth not understanding, else would it have taught Hesiod and Pythagoras, and again Xenophanes and Hecateus. Pythagoras claimed for his own wisdom what was but a knowledge of many things and an art of mischief. The one exception to his condemnation is Teutamus, who is signalled out as of more account than the rest. When we inquire the reason for this praise, we find that Teutamus said, "Most men are bad." His contempt for mankind leads him to think that only force will compel them to act for their own good. He says, "Every beast is driven to the pasture with blows," and again, "Asses would rather have straw than gold." As might be expected, Heraclitus believes in war. "War," he says, "is the father of all and the king of all, and some he has made gods and some men, some bond and some free." Again, "Homer was wrong in saying, Would that strife might perish from among gods and men." He did not see that he was praying for the destruction of the universe, for if his prayer were heard, all things would pass away. And yet again, "We must know that war is common to all, and strife is justice, and that all things come into being and pass away through strife. His ethic is a kind of proud asceticism, very similar to Nietzsche's. He regards the soul as a mixture of fire and water, the fire being noble and the water ignoble. The soul that has most fire he calls dry. The dry soul is the wisest and best. It is pleasure to souls to become moist. A man, when he gets drunk, is led by a beardless lad, tripping, knowing not where he steps, having his soul moist. It is death to souls to become water. It is hard to fight with one's heart's desire. Whatever it wishes to get, it purchases at the cost of soul. It is not good for men to get all that they wish to get. One may say that Heraclitus values power obtained through self-mastery and despises the passions that distract men from their central ambitions. The attitude of Heraclitus to the religions of his time, at any rate the Bacchic religion, is largely hostile, but not with the hostility of a scientific rationalist. He has his own religion, and in part interprets current theology to fit his doctrine, in part rejects it with considerable scorn. He has been called Bacchic by Cornford, and regarded as an interpreter of the mysteries by Pfleiderer. I do not think the relevant fragments bear out this view. He says, for example, the mysteries practiced among men are unholy mysteries. This suggests that he had in mind possible mysteries that would not be unholy, but would be quite different from those that existed. He would have been a religious reformer if he had not been too scornful of the vulgar to engage in propaganda. The following are all the extant sayings of Heraclitus that bear on his attitude to the theology of his day. The Lord, who is the oracle at Delphi, neither utters nor hides his meaning, but shows it by a sign. And the Sibyl, with raving lips, uttering things mirthless, unbedizened and unperfumed, reaches over 1,000 years with her voice, thanks to the God in her. Souls smell in Hades. Greater deaths win greater portions. Those who die then become gods. Nightwalkers, magicians, priests of Bacchus, and priestesses of the wine vat, mystery mongers. The mysteries practiced among men are unholy mysteries. And they pray to these images as if one were to talk with a man's house, knowing not what gods or heroes are. For if it were not to Dionysus that they made a procession and sang the shameful phallic hymn, they would be acting most shamelessly. But Hades is the same as Dionysus, in whose honour they go mad and keep the feast of the wine vat. They vainly purify themselves by defiling themselves with blood, just as if one who had stepped into the mud were to wash his feet in mud. Any man who marked him doing this would deem him mad. Heraclitus believed fire to be the primordial element, out of which everything else had arisen. Thales, the reader will remember, thought everything was made of water. Anaximenes thought air was the primitive element. Heraclitus preferred fire. At last, Empedocles suggested a statesmanlike compromise by allowing four elements, earth, air, fire, and water. The chemistry of the ancients stopped dead at this point. No further progress was made in this science until the Mohammedan alchemists embarked upon their search for the philosopher's stone, the elixir of life, and a method of transmuting base metals into gold. The metaphysics of Heraclitus are sufficiently dynamic to satisfy the most hustling of moderns. This world, which is the same for all, no one of gods or men has made, but it was ever, is now, and ever shall be an ever-living fire, with measures kindling and measures going out. The transformations of fire are first of all sea, and half of the sea is earth, half whirlwind. In such a world, perpetual change was to be expected, and perpetual change was what Heraclitus believed in. He had, however, another doctrine, on which he set even more store than on the perpetual flux. This was the doctrine of the mingling of opposites. Men do not know, he says, how what is at variance agrees with itself. It is an attunement of opposite tensions, like that of the bow and the lyre. His belief in strife is connected with this theory. For in strife, opposites combine to produce a motion which is a harmony. There is a unity in the world, but it is a unity resulting from diversity. Couples are things whole and things not whole. What is drawn together and what is drawn asunder, the harmonious and the discordant. The one is made up of all things, and all things issue from the one. Sometimes he speaks as if the unity were more fundamental than the diversity. Good and ill are one. To God, all things are fair and good and right, but men hold some things wrong and some right. The way up and the way down is one and the same. God is day and night, winter and summer, war and peace, surfeit and hunger. But he takes various shapes, just as fire, when it is mingled with spices, is named according to the savour of each. Nevertheless, there would be no unity if there were not opposites to combine. It is the opposite which is good for us. This doctrine contains the germ of Hegel's philosophy, which proceeds by a synthesizing of opposites. The metaphysics of Heraclitus, like that of Anaximander, is dominated by a conception of cosmic justice, which prevents the strife of opposites from ever issuing in the complete victory of either. All things are an exchange for fire, and fire for all things, even as wares for gold and gold for wares. Fire lives the death of air, and air lives the death of fire. Water lives the death of earth, earth that of water. The sun will not overstep his measure. If he does, the Erinnyes, the handmaids of justice, will find him out. We must know that war is common to all, and strife is justice. Heraclitus repeatedly speaks of God as distinct from the gods. The way of man has no wisdom, but that of God has. Man is called a baby by God, even as a child by a man. The wisest man is an ape compared to God, just as the most beautiful ape is ugly compared to man. God, no doubt, is the embodiment of cosmic justice. The doctrine that everything is in a state of flux is the most famous of the opinions of Heraclitus, and the one most emphasized by his disciples, as described in Plato's Theaetetus. You cannot step twice into the same river, for fresh waters are ever flowing in upon you. Footnote. But compare, we step and do not step into the same rivers, we are and are not. End of footnote. The sun is new every day. His belief in universal change is commonly supposed to have been expressed in the phrase, all things are flowing. But this is probably apocryphal, like Washington's Father, I cannot tell a lie, and Wellington's Up guards an atom. His works, like those of all the philosophers before Plato, are only known through quotations, largely made by Plato or Aristotle for the sake of refutation. When one thinks what would become of any modern philosopher if he were only known through the polemics of his rivals, one can see how admirable the pre-Socratics must have been, since even through the mist of malice spread by their enemies, they still appear great. However this may be, Plato and Aristotle agree that Heraclitus taught that nothing ever is, everything is becoming, Plato, and that nothing steadfastly is, Aristotle. I shall return to the consideration of this doctrine in connection with Plato, who is much concerned to refute it. For the present, I shall not investigate what philosophy has to say about it, but only what the poets have felt and the men of science have taught. The search for something permanent is one of the deepest of the instincts leading men to philosophy. It is derived, no doubt, from love of home and desire for a refuge from danger. We find, accordingly, that it is most passionate in those whose lives are most exposed to catastrophe. Religion seeks permanence in two forms, God and immortality. In God is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. The life after death is eternal and unchanging. The cheerfulness of the 19th century turned men against these static conceptions, and modern liberal theology believes that there is progress in heaven and evolution in the Godhead. But even in this conception, there is something permanent, namely progress itself and its imminent goal. And a dose of disaster is likely to bring men's hopes back to their older super-terrestrial forms. If life on Earth is despaired of, it is only in heaven that peace can be sought. The poets have lamented the power of time to sweep away every object of their love. Time doth transfix the flourish set on youth, and delves the parallels in beauty's brow, feeds on the rarities of nature's truth, and nothing stands but for his scythe to mow. They generally add that their own verses are indestructible, and yet to times in hope my verse shall stand, praising thy worth despite his cruel hand. But this is only a conventional literary conceit. Philosophically inclined mystics, unable to deny that whatever is in time is transitory, have invented a conception of eternity as not persistence through endless time, but existence outside the whole temporal process. Eternal life, according to some theologians, for example Dean Ing, does not mean existence throughout every moment of future time, but a mode of being wholly independent of time, in which there is no before and after, and therefore no logical possibility of change. This view has been poetically expressed by Vaughan. I saw eternity the other night, like a great ring of pure and endless light, all calm as it was bright, and round beneath it, time in hours, days, years, driven by the spheres like a vast shadow moved, in which the world and all her train were hurled. Several of the most famous systems of philosophy have tried to state this conception in sober prose, as expressing what reason, patiently pursued, will ultimately compel us to believe. Heraclitus himself, for all his belief in change, allowed something everlasting. The conception of eternity, as opposed to endless duration, which comes from Parmenides, is not to be found in Heraclitus, but in his philosophy the central fire never dies. The world was, ever is now, and ever shall be an ever-living fire,